Hey, this is Jack Wall. You're listening to the Sound Architect Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Architect Podcast. I am your host, Sam Hughes, and today I am joined by composer Jack Wall. Thanks for joining me today, Jack. How are you?
Hey, Sam. Good, man. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And very excited to have you on the show today.
Happy to be here. You're in Finland, I'm in Portugal.
I know, lovely. It must be a very opposite world right now. I can't imagine there's a lot of snow in Portugal.
No, you have snow there though.
Yes, we have a lot.
We have rain and I'm at the beach, so I'm just watching the waves crash, which is pretty cool.
Nice, very cool. Do you surf?
No.
No.
I don't.
Sounds like a great opportunity if you did.
I know, I might want to learn.
Just go out and surf in the rain. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's like so cold out there.
Now, before we discuss your recent work on Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War, I'd love to ask you a bit more about your journey into music composition overall. Like, how did you first get into music composition?
Well, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a meandering path. I started out, you know, my professional life as a civil engineer, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. Very different.
I really loved going to school for it. It was fun. You know, it was, I like math, science, and all that kind of stuff. I'm kind of good at it. And I just enjoyed the challenge of it. But when I got into the real world and started doing actual engineering work, it was pretty, I don't know what to say. It just wasn't inspiring to me to work in that field. You really have to go way down the rabbit hole before you can even get a chance to like design like a giant bridge or something like that. Like,
yeah.
You know, people don't just give you that opportunity without knowing that you know what you're doing. So
yeah, I can imagine you had that creative thirst.
Yeah. So I wanted to do something a little more creative and I was always a musician. So, although, you know, to make a living, I sought out bartending, which was one of the best jobs I ever had. Very social job, fun job, met a lot of great people. I was in Philadelphia at the time and I was waiting on people like Mayor Ed Rendell, you know, he used to be the mayor of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Many years ago. But he went off to be some other kind of congressman or something.
I think bartending teaches you quite a lot, to be honest. I was a bartender at one point as well, like many people. And I think you do actually gain a lot of skills, like soft skills from doing it.
I agree. I really believe it was one of the greatest jobs I ever had. Not that I would go back to it necessarily, but it was a formative position and I really enjoyed it. It was really fun. And then from there, you know, I had a band and I was working with the band doing some demos at a recording studio in Philadelphia. And I fell in love with the recording studio immediately. It was like, I just couldn't believe how fun that was. It's like, wow, this is fun. You know, you can actually manipulate sound and create really fun ways of producing music and stuff like that. So I sort of pursued it at that point. That was pretty early. I was like 20, 25 when I decided to do that, which is kind of a late start these days, you know, like 25. And then, you know, I did sound engineering and mixing for like 8 years. So I didn't really get into, you know, composing music until I was in my 30s. So, you know, it was a very late bloomer that way. And I got into that because my girlfriend at the time, who wasn't my girlfriend, had a band with, and they were doing demos for Capitol Records. And I got to know her and she was a game designer during the day. And,
oh, cool.
She kind of introduced me to the whole world of games and, you know, what they had become since I was playing arcade games in my youth, you know, but, the computer game sort of, revelation was happening. It was around 1994. And that was about a year after the CD-ROM was first introduced where you could have real kind of, storage for computers.
All those amazing effects.
Right. So, you know, before that, it was all bleeps and bloops and FM synthesis and stuff like that. So that was the bleeps and bloops area before that. And so I came in right at the right time, you know, to scoring for games and things like that. I started in 1995 was my first game.
Nice. Yeah. So that's how long ago is that now? I'm losing track of time. 16 years ago? 26 years ago. Oh, wow.
Just about 26. Yeah.
How has it felt to still be doing it? When you first did it, did you expect that this was where your career was going to go?
Yeah, I'm not one of those people who grew up listening to, you know, John Williams and people like that and thinking, oh, I want to do that for a living. I, of course, I was a fan of John Williams, but that wasn't the impetus for me getting into composing. The impetus for me getting into composing was that I played the game Myst and saw that there was this really interesting new way to write music for media that didn't exist before, really. Yeah. So that was kind of fun. It was like, I can do this. This is a brand new thing. I can get in on the ground floor. No one's doing this yet. You know, because you have to understand, I didn't go to school for composition. I just wanted to use my skills as a sound engineer and mix engineer. And over time, I had done more and more things with music. You know, I was working for John Cale at the time, and I was, you know, doing some arranging for him and things like that. I started getting into working with strings and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of a natural progression to sort of go in that direction.
Yeah, I'm just wondering as well, was there any transferable skills from civil engineering that you managed to carry over?
You know, it's so funny because, you know, when I first started engineering, I ran into like two or three people that were all civil engineers working in the sound field, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was working in the studio in Boston called Synchro Sound Studios, and I was working with this other guy, Glenn Navia, and he was also like, he went to school for civil engineering and he was a recording engineer. So I don't know,
you
know,
surprisingly common.
It's one of those things where you kind of learn how to learn. Like when I went to school for engineering for, I would say 10, 12 years after I graduated, I thought, wow, I just wasted so much money and time. I shouldn't have gone to school for that. Cause I'm not doing that. But then over time you start to realize, oh, you know, all the things that I was doing in school, it's like I learned how to learn. Like I don't need to go back to school for anything. I can actually pick up any knowledge I need. I already know how to do that. And it took me a long time to understand, you know, that it wasn't wasted time. So I would say, yeah, civil engineering is really part of who I am. It's to this day, it's like solving problems is like, you know, piece of cake for me.
Yeah.
and as a composer, it's nothing if not constantly solving problems, you know. How can I write this piece of music? Can I produce it? I'm in Portugal right now. I have a really crappy laptop and I have to write like 12 minutes of music for two different recording sessions that are happening in a week and a half. So, you know, I will solve that problem and I will get it done.
Nice. And I'm curious on that then. So with you being in Portugal and working remote, as most of us are, what are some of your solutions for coming up with writing music right now?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm always trying to do is shake up how I write, you know, like when I'm home at my beautiful recording studio that I've been, you know, working on for the last couple dozen years. And it's now exactly like I like it and all that kind of thing. I came to Portugal just for a break and we got stuck here. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
We came here just for a vacation and during COVID, maybe not the smartest thing in the world to do, but we just figured, hey, you know, you could be stuck anywhere. Why not be stuck at the beach in Portugal?
So, I mean, that's also a fair point. There are worse places to be stuck.
There are worse places to be stuck. So here we are, and then I get called. You know, we were supposed to fly back several weeks ago, January 21st, and then the UK strain and the South African strain happened, and then they just canceled all our flights.
Yeah.
So here we are stuck, and I'm going back in March now, early March, and so now I'm just using my laptop and a keyboard, little keyboard that I just bought on Amazon and they delivered it here.
Nice.
And I'm just kind of, you know, working with basic samples, mostly piano. And I'm writing using a piano, which to me is like, it's a very musical way to write. It's just that a lot of times you don't want to be, you want to be more about sounds and interesting ambiences and things like that.
It's hard to get those nuances when it's all on the same keyboard.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm working with my assistant back in LA and also another guy here in Portugal who I met, who's a fantastic music producer, and he's going to mock up some of my stuff.
Oh, nice.
And we're going to go
it's
back
great
and
when
forth.
That works
yeah, he's
out.
Working on a, It's pretty fun. His name's Pedro Camacho. He's a just a sweetheart of a guy and great composer. He works on the what is that series? Star Citizen. Do you know that game?
Yeah, by Cloud Imperium, yeah.
Yeah, he does a lot of that music and it's great, great music. So, you know, we became friends over here and, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, we're just in the same time zone. He's actually in Madeira, which is about 1,000 miles from where I am.
But oh, right.
It's still Portugal, technically.
Just goes to show how small the world really is again, in the industry especially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It does help to be in the same time zone, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's talk about Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War. Now, you've been a part of the franchise since Black Ops 2, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so what was it like when you got back on the project? Is it as simple as them going, hey, Jack, we want you back for another game? Or do you still have to sort of pitch yourself to be the composer for it?
You know, I don't know. At this point, this is my fourth Call of Duty game. And it's almost like they're part of my family and I'm part of their family. We just get along really well. We see eye to eye on almost everything. It's just a great synergy between us. I work with a guy named Brian Tuohy, first and foremost, but all the people there. And, you know, they worked with Raven a lot, Raven Software, on this game, because this kind of came out of the blue, because I guess Sledgehammer is working on the next installment for 2020. And some things were happening at the studio that prevented them from going down that path. And so Activision called on Treyarch to come in a year earlier than they normally would have.
Because oh, wow.
They sort of tag team studios to get all the Call of Duties out each year. It's like each studio, there's three studios and they have 3 years basically to put out a game. So suddenly last, I think it was November, December of 2019, they got the notice that they were on deck a year earlier to do it. So I just basically had to, you know, I got a call to, hey, we're doing this a year early. I think I saw something in the trades about it. And then like the following week, I got a call, you know, hey, Jack, guess what? And so, you know, they just had me come right aboard and work. So there's no auditioning that I have to. I did on the first one, I auditioned.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, they know what I do, and I always write different music for each one, and they're not worried I'm going to repeat myself too much.
Yeah, I think after three games, it's kind of got to the point where you're like, okay, I think you know how we work now.
yeah, and that's like I value that a lot. It's wonderful to have that kind of relationship with somebody. You know, that's what as a composer you crave that, because not only is it, you know, sort of job security in a way.
Yeah.
But it's also just really nice to go back to working with the same people again on a different project. And everyone's excited to work together again. And, you know, the energy is there. The desire to do great work is always there. And I love those people. They're just great people.
Yeah. And the language between you has already kind of been defined by that point. So it's easier to communicate, right?
That's right. And one of the side benefits for me is that Brian never thinks I can't write something. So somebody says to him, hey, we're going to do a big band on this thing. Who should we get to do it? And Brian just immediately says, well, we'll get Jack to do it. And so I get to write big band music and it's just really fun.
Nice.
I just love that aspect of, you know, they just don't think that I can't do it, you know. They don't think I'm deficit in any style of music, and I use that to my advantage to prove to myself that I can do it as well. And I love that part of it. It's you know, it keeps it fresh, keeps everything fresh. I'm not writing the same music over and over again. That's wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. And following on from that, then, what kind of pitch did they give you about the game and the brief for the music for this title? Because obviously they must have been like, okay, so yeah, previously we did this, but this time we're going to go for this kind of approach. And how did they pitch it to you musically?
Well, it's usually a collaboration between Brian and I, like what we're going to do. And he and I just had a few conversations about it early on. And he said, you know, I'd love to bring some synthesizer into this from the 80s. But, you know, instead of just, and then he sent me some examples that he was talking about. But he said, instead of doing it exactly like this, let's modernize it, you know?
Nice.
Because there is sort of a dated quality to the 80s music that, you know, you can nail that, but Is that what you really want it to sound like?
Yeah.
You
know? Plus, there is a lot of it about recently after everything like Stranger Things and loads of other people emulating the 80s.
That's right. The danger is to sound like all this stuff in popular culture right now that sounds like that. So
yeah,
we wanted to set ourselves apart a little bit. So sort of 80s synth mixed with orchestra and choir. Choir was kind of an iffy thing. But then once I discovered that it was going to be called Cold War, it's like, well, I got to have some Russian choir in this. So all of that plus, you know, let's modernize that 80s sound. So it sounds fresh, you know.
Yeah, nice. And how has your musical journey with the Black Ops franchise influenced the way you write? Or more specifically, how did it help you approach this score, knowing the franchise so well?
Yeah, you know, Call of Duty is the next Black Ops, but there's really no thread that goes through all of the Black Ops series. They're all very different.
Yeah.
You know, I just try to vary the score as much as I can. With Cold War, it was kind of interesting for me because most of the storylines that are written for Black Ops are just really seriously convoluted. Like they're really tough to follow. They always mix like a lot of, you know, occult, you know, stuff in there that you're not quite sure where that comes from. And then, you know, it's sometimes just hard to follow the story when you're looking at the story on a blank page. So it's hard for me to understand what I'm writing until I get into it. With Cold War, it was different because the whole milieu, the environment was the Cold War, which is the early 80s. I grew up in the early 80s, so I understood what that was. I remember Reagan and, you know, him dealing with Brezhnev and all these things where, you know, there's sort of like we had our own perception of what Russia was at the time.
Yeah.
And so in terms of writing music for that period of time, there was a bit of that, but there was also, I had this interest in discovering what was the Russian viewpoint on America at that time. And so my wife, Cindy, she and I worked together on stuff a lot. And she was the one who went out and did all the research and figured out, like, you know, she got declassified CIA documents and
oh wow
and read them about the Russian viewpoint of America. So, and then we wrote the lyrics to Cold War based on that. She wrote them in English, then we translated them to Russian, and there was a whole process for recording the choir in COVID times that was pretty intense, but that's what we did.
Yeah, I can imagine that was tricky trying to get that together.
In answer to your question, I just felt like the story was so much more contained, and it was kind of it was like writing a film score, really, you know, because it was all about the Cold War as the backdrop of this game. And then the story was on top of that, where you're finding this, you know, Russian terrorist and you're trying to stop him from doing bad things. So it was a really contained story. It was easy to follow it.
Yeah.
More easy to follow it. And so I was able to write themes right at the top that I knew would carry through the whole game. Bell's theme, which he's the character you play. And then Cold War was sort of the ode to Russia, really. And I got a lot of great emails and tweets from Russians, like Russian nationals, who really appreciated what we were doing, which was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
And then, and then there was another theme called 1981, which was sort of that, you know, that's where I started as the first thing I wrote, which was that synthesizer mixed with, you know, modernizing it and all that. So those themes run through the game pretty much all the way through. And I even used the 1981 theme in Rising Tide, you know, the theme I wrote with Big Giant Circles for multiplayer.
Yeah, that one's awesome, I have to say. I love a bit of 80s and synthwave, and that one just really struck a chord with me especially. And I wanted to ask, like, with regards to that sort of 80s setting but making it modern, how did you touch the 80s setting but with a modern edge in your music?
Well, it's like, you know, Rising Tide's a perfect example of, like, we use drums that were really modern sounding. You know, the drums do not sound like they did in the 80s,
no,
for example, but the synthesizers do. So that was a really good example of that. In the other themes, you know, we would just use you know, the way that I modernized it was I just sort of did my own thing to it, you know, using the synthesizers, but then doing what I would normally do as a composer for a game, and just write a great theme and make it sound just, you know, modern production style and all that. So.
Awesome. And you guys have worked together before, haven't you? Big Giant Circles. You collaborated.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we started working together on Mass Effect, the Mass Effect series. You brought him in. He's just a great guy and a great composer. Like, the stuff he writes is so... Like, when he writes score, it sounds like a song, you know?
Nice.
And that's what I really love about Jimmy. So, and he's also easy to work with. We just go back and forth and play with ideas and... You know, I'll see what he's doing and I'll add to it. And I love that kind of collaboration. It's just really fulfilling to me.
Yeah. And I wanted to touch on how you mentioned the Russian perspective earlier. So obviously you can tell that in the theme, like you say, with the Russian lyrics and things like that. But one that stood out to me as well was Comrade, which is a very cool and interesting dark chant track in the beginning, like, you know, very reminiscent of things like the Dies Irae in some ways. And then, you know, it kind of takes this very dark turn. Like, the strings come in, they're very emotional and powerful, but then there's this dark digital edge as well that just kind of swipes through, and it kind of, it's such a mixture. Like, how did you get inspired to write something like that and bring all those elements together?
Well, Comrade was written for the end of the game, where you fail. you can win this game or you can fail at this game. I'm not going to get into how you do those things.
Yeah, of course, need to avoid spoilers.
But I wanted to do sort of the somber, you know, Russian choir version of our themes. And so that's what that is. I just rearranged that theme for choir and slowed it way down.
Yeah.
To denote the fact that this is very sad.
Yes.
And then it goes into the actual ending of the game. Even if you the next bit is, even if you win the game, something bad happens. So I hope that's not a spoiler, but that was written to picture the string
nice.
Part was written to a scene that happens at the end of the game. So yeah, I just sort of like edited those things together because they were related.
Yeah.
They were both parts of the end of the game and just how that works out. And I just thought they went well together as a listening experience.
Yeah.
So you'll never hear it in the game played like that, but
no, it was cool. I really enjoyed it. It kind of caught me off guard when you think it's over, like after the chant finishes, and then it's just like boom.
Yeah. And then it ends with the cello playing bells. Theme,
yeah. You know. And one of the things I love about this soundtrack is that great range that you have. Like, 1 minute is this epic cinematic emotional feel, and then you also have this like synthesizer edge, the dark cold side. But I have to admit, there's also, it still has that bit of that dark element, but one of the more fun tracks that I really enjoyed, one of my favorites, was Cuban Crisis, which, contrary to the title, obviously, it's, you know, it's a very negative title, but the track actually kind of felt quite nice, and it was, you know, especially throughout the beginning.
Well, cool. I'm glad you liked that one. I haven't actually talked about that one before. Well, you know, for that one, I just get my friends, my MB and my other friend Erwin, to play some great percussion. Because MB's really good at that sort of Cuban thing. He can do any style, and you know, I just wanted to get some of that flavor into that level because that's what it was. And that obviously it's a very upbeat sound, but it was fun to throw some orchestra on top of that.
Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, that was just really, really a good level for writing, music that feels like it belongs in the level and yet has some kind of, you know, there's some melodic thread that, you know, gets hit that is related to the rest of the game as well. That's what I'm talking about. I'm sort of like threading these themes throughout the game, no matter what kind of style we're writing.
Yeah. And I love that cinematic feel. Obviously, you know, we say the word cinematic quite a lot, and that can be used for games in a lot of references. But the way you're talking about the score is that you can just bring these motifs and melodies throughout and tie them in and weave them in a way that fits.
Oh yeah, when I'm writing for a game, I don't really treat it any differently than I would a film. I feel like I'm writing an interactive film and we're telling a story. So there's no difference really, except that, you know, you gotta know a little bit about how games work and how to transition from one bit to the next depending on what the player does, and that's the interactive part of writing that's more technical. But yeah, other than that, it is basically you're trying to find the rises and falls in emotion that you would in a movie. And to that end, I usually take a video capture of a level. So I have a giant movie of the level playthrough, and then we'll decide where music plays, what and sort of craft the emotional arc of that level before we even start writing at all.
Yeah.
Sounds like a spotting session like you would do for a film. So
yeah, and with regards to that then, I assume that you don't really handle the implementation side, but you write it with that in mind.
Absolutely. And I have done before. I did that on Mass Effect 2. I implemented the entire score myself with my assistant.
Awesome.
And I learned a great deal from that process because it is, you know, I have a great respect for people who do it because it's really hard.
Yeah, it's tough,
to do
man.
Right and do well. Yeah. And it was good for me to learn how to do it in such a detailed manner. I don't think Mass Effect 2 is perfect in its implementation, but it's pretty good. You know, I was pretty happy with how it was implemented, especially over Mass Effect 1, which I had nothing to do with, and was kind of the impetus for me wanting to do Mass Effect 2, wanting to do the implementation myself. And again, it's not perfect, but I was pretty happy with how that turned out. And from that experience, I take that to every game I work on now. I can direct somebody on how to implement something, how I'm intending it to be implemented. And really, to do it well, you got to go back and forth two or three times, you know, before you get it exactly right. And I wish we had more time on this one, but I thought they did a pretty good job on it.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest challenges as a composer for games. Like, obviously, listening to the soundtrack in isolation on Spotify or whatever is great, and you get like the really nice released version of the soundtrack. But it's very, very different in game when you have these long levels and you're like, okay, we need to kind of score this bit up to this point, and then we'll change it here, and we'll have these layers coming in and out here and there. Like, how did you decide, from that perspective, what stems and layers to be like, okay, right, well, when this happens, we'll bring in this, and when that happens, we'll change to this, and then, you know, throughout the gameplay side.
Right. So generally speaking, what I do is I decide what I'm writing for every moment of a level and where music doesn't go, shouldn't go, where it should just be all about the fighting or the silence or the whatever.
Yeah.
When I'm composing and when I'm producing, I do all of that at the same time. So as I'm composing, I'm mixing, you know. When I'm finally done composing, I hit print, and I'm printing stems that are fairly wide, that aren't, you know, not crazy, maybe a dozen or so stems that they can then later use any way they want, you know. And then sometime midway through production, I'll usually have my assistants, or I'll hire a few people, editors, to take all of my music, including all the stems, and create a library of music from that.
Nice.
That can be used later on when inevitably all of the cinematics come in at the very last minute.
What do you
right
mean?
Before
that
they're
never
launching
happens.
This game. And I can typically get the really important cinematics much earlier because they prioritize those so I can score them custom. But then there'll be like 50 movies that come in that are all interstitial movies that serve as transitional in the game and are really important. And
yeah.
I have a great team of editors and who put this, you know, take this library that we've created as we went along and edit that in as though it was custom scored. And then you get two benefits from that. You get it done really fast, which is needed because you're
always
launching
good.
This game in 2 weeks. And then the other benefit is you really do feel like we label all the themes what they're for. And so when they're scoring a scene, they can say, okay, this theme is for Hudson, so we're going to use some of Hudson's theme, or, you know, whatever in this section. And maybe it's just strings because it's all underscore, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, there might be a brass stinger at the end or something. And it looks and feels like it's custom scored because it kind of is. It's just edited to deal with the time constraints. And we're at that point, we're already done recording. So it works out really well. I'm really proud of the fact that we do that.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that as well, because that's another challenge that composers face, is that you're not necessarily writing everything in order based on what happened previously like you would a movie. You know, the cinematics, like you say, often come in late, and then you're writing to mm-hmm. levels as they come in. So do you get given the whole script and like some story treatment and be like, okay, so this is what's happened before? You know, do you score anything in your mind in those gaps in between, or do you have to try and kind of keep this thread in the middle?
Again, it's, you know, those things I wait until I see them. So that typically comes in late. And, you know, the process that we, by which we do this is something that I do have control over, even though I'm not doing the editing necessarily on all these, because I'm still writing.
Yeah.
But I do get to, I'll look at the, before the client, even before Treyarch even sees these movies scored, I'll go through a couple iterations if necessary with the editor to make sure it's how I would like to see it done. But you know, it's a fun process, because you're almost really just tidying up in a way, and you're really starting to make these connections between all these scenes finally. And it actually really starts to feel like, oh, this was the pitch perfect. This is, you know, this is exactly how it should feel all the way through this game. And, you know, could we do better? Always. We're never happy, completely happy with what we've done. But that's a nice process to go through at the very end, where you can sort of create these the connecting threads between these scenes with these movies and other things too. And then you've got situations where, in this particular situation, we had some really creative sound designers at Raven, and they did a lot of the editing for me. Like, I didn't even have my team do it, because they were like, no, here's one we did. What do you think? I was like, oh, this is fantastic.
Awesome.
You guys use the right themes. You use the right, you know, the right tonalities. Fantastic. And they're like, great, we'll just take care of all these now. I'm like, okay, do it. So they were just really happy to have, you know, that sort of edited and labeled, like, we label each of the files with tempo and key. And if any of that is important. And then so you can literally go through all of the library and just start piecing things together just based on the name. And then, you know, you can,
it's almost like paint by numbers in a way, you know, like,
it's
here's
really
the stuff,
like paint by numbers. Like... it's funny. I mean, I hate to reduce what I do to that, but you know, really at the end of the day, that's it. And then the final check on all that is me looking at it and saying, yeah, this is working.
Yeah. Nice. And aside from things being ready earlier, which would always be great, how do you think we can advance in other ways when writing scores for games? Because obviously, like you say, you do a lot of prep work because you're used to how the development cycle works. Now, aside from everything suddenly being available all at once, which isn't going to happen, like, what else could you see advancing and improving when writing scores for games?
Oh, I don't know. I think we ought to all talk to... what's his name? Ori, the guy who did Ori.
Oh, Gareth Coker.
His name, right? Gareth Coker. So I was just watching a video that they put together for him for an awards thing, and I was just blown away.
Yeah. Like,
it was all implemented. It's all about implementation. Implementation is key. And I just thought that the Will-O-The-Wisp's score was implemented so perfectly and so beautifully written.
Yeah.
Like, there was just a beautiful soundtrack. Marriage of both of those things. It's just fantastic. Really fantastic. I was very proud of him. He's quite a talent. But yeah, I think it really is about just better implementation, you know, really seamless implementation. And that it really is the tough part.
Yeah.
You know, that's the tough part, because you're always under the gun to make it work. And it really takes severe talent to pull it off. Somebody really gets, like, you know, how to do that.
Yeah, well, the modern composer needs to know more and more all the time, don't they? Especially if you want to write for games. It's like, okay, so you not only have to be good at writing music, you also have to be good at production. You also have to be good at this. You have to be good at implementation and writing for implementation.
Like, well, you know, Sony's been doing that for years, like, yeah. Sony Computer Entertainment. They've had their own people in-house that do all that technical stuff and do a very good, that's why they keep winning awards all the time, because they're so good at that. And they don't care if the composer knows how to do any of that stuff. They just say, okay, here's what we need from you. We need all these stems, and we need to, these are the stems we need, and make sure you do that. And that's easy for any composer to do. So they just take all that off the composer. I do think it does help though, if the composer knows a little bit about it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I have to say, one of the big challenges that even I've come across sometimes is, even when you know about music and you know about audio, trying to communicate to a composer what you want and how you want it can sometimes be insanely tricky, even if you on paper know what you want.
Yeah.
You know, getting that language together where you can communicate cohesively and be like, okay, so this is what I'm going to need. I want this, 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 and this, and I need you to write it this way, and I want the style to be this. Getting all that together in like a nice way to deliver it to the composer is very, very hard, because all of a sudden you become on the other side of the table where, we joke about how people mention about sound with these weird words like fluffy or more purple or, you know, trying to convey something. And then all of a sudden you're on that side of the table going, yeah, well, actually, no, I do want that to be harsher or grittier, or how else do I describe this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing some stuff right now that's really short throw. They want to record it, and they're giving me like a week to write it, and then I might have another week for changes, but it's going to be an interesting moment when people I've never worked with before, here's my piece, what do you think? And then have them come back and say what they're going to say, because it really is about what they're looking for, and they can describe all day long what they're looking for, but if they don't hear it, what they're thinking, then I got to start over. And then the schedule gets even more insane because everyone's waiting for me on a certain day, sitting in chairs with their violins and whatnot, and better be ready.
Yeah. And as a concept, it's also quite marvelous that we've managed to do this, because if you think about it in its basic premise, it's like, hey, a person who can do this, write what I'm thinking of. Right, what's in my head? Yeah. You're like,
take
okay,
it right out of my
go.
Head. Yeah, it's like we need the Harry Potter pensive, you know? Like,
yeah.
Pull it out with a wand, put it in my head.
And the classic placeholder, it's like, okay, this, but not this.
Like, yeah. Well, part of the art of being a composer, though, is to understand what they're talking about.
Of course, it's learning the language.
I know what they really want. I know they're saying this, but I know they really want this.
Yeah, and you must have things in your mind where, you know, they say stuff and you're like, oh yeah, I know what they mean. Or if you're not sure, you're kind of like, okay, you could mean this or this. So here's option A and here's option B. Which one were you thinking of?
Yeah.
So going back to Cold War then, I'm curious as well, because we talked about a lot of 80s media being around these days, or 80s references, and there was also over the years and even recently a lot of Cold War references throughout media, or even Cold War media. Did you make any sort of conscious effort to pay homage to any other Cold War references, either musically or, you know, even movies or TV programs or anything?
Yeah, well, if I had to define for you what the Russian sound of music is, I mean, I would look at Tchaikovsky, I would look at, you know, Rachmaninoff and, you know, other Russian composers. But really in popular culture, it's more like Crimson Tide and, you know, those references, the sort of Russian movie war references of the time. And, you know, all of that is valid because when you hear it, it puts you in that place. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. I just felt like when I figured out that, because we didn't know for many months that the game was going to be called Cold War.
Oh, you right.
Know? It started off as Black Ops 5, and we knew it wasn't going to end up being Black Ops 5. We knew it was set in the Cold War, but we didn't yet have a title till like April. And once I learned that that was the title, it changed everything for me. It was like, okay, this is the signature for this game. Therefore, I need to make the signature sound Russian, whatever that means, right?
Yeah.
That's where I started. And then I had already recorded a number of themes, the Bells theme and 1981, with both choir and full choir and orchestra. So that was done, mixed, done and dusted. And it was funny at that time, because like at that point, it was so kind of early in the process. Like Brian and I were like, we don't know what we're going to use these themes for, you know? And I was like, well, we'll find something. And if we don't, I'm going to be using these themes throughout the score anyway. So yeah, at least we'll have that and they'll be on the soundtrack. But we did end up using them in the menus.
Oh, nice.
Which is perfect. Or credits and stuff like that too is good for that. And because you've heard the themes throughout, it works. But then there was Cold War came out as, okay, this is going to be the title. And I thought, okay, so for, and then can you write something for the opening menu screen? And I thought, yeah, because that was kind of what I was trying to do with the first two themes. But I realized they weren't great menu themes necessarily for the opening. So I thought, I'm going to do something darker and more Russian. And so I wrote Cold War, the actual theme for the game. And that was like, okay, instead of, because before that point, I was like, I'm not doing the choir again. That's just too hard. Because we had to record every single person in the choir by themselves.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a whole process. And I thought, and it was all this translation and transliteration and getting American singers and English-speaking people, you know, English speakers to sing Russian properly with a bona fide, you know, translator and somebody who is a singer themselves and understands how to phonetically spell out this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It's tricky and it takes time. It took us 2 weeks or something when normally I could do it in 4 hours. So I just decided at that point, okay, we're going to have more choir, but this time I just want this masculine sound. I'm just going to have men. And that was the right call. Cause then it was just like, and I just had this sort of like, it was almost like a march, you know,
definitely S, gets that vibe.
Air, you know, which is SSS air is you know, CCCP spelled out.
Right. Okay. Right? Yeah.
Which is USSR. Those are the first lyrics. And it was just this cool kind of cadence that said immediately, this is the Cold War era and these are Russians. And I was pretty pleased with that.
Yeah, and I think you've touched on a few things that some composers or some people might not realize is how much research goes into music composition. Some people think that, you know, you get asked to write this thing and you get asked to score a game about the Cold War and you just bash it out. That's it. You just know stuff, man. Like, but it's like, no, you have to kind of research stuff and look into how, you know, their approach was and also like, okay, what elements could I use? Oh, maybe that, but I don't know about that. Let's look into that a bit more. And, you know, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like that's one of my favorite parts of the process. Like,
yeah.
I don't even start writing for a month or so after I begin, because I feel like why write something if I'm not prepared to do, you know, to really understand what I'm writing.
Yeah.
So I read everything. I read all the scripts. I look at the artwork. I look at the gameplay, talk to the designers, ask them questions. You know, what's the motivation of these characters? Who's the bad guy? Who's the good guy? Is he all bad? Is he all good?
Yeah. Why is he bad? Why is he good?
Why is he? Yeah, exactly. All that. And I try to get into the head of the designer as much as I can, because they know all this stuff already. I mean, they typically are really good at what they do, and people just don't understand how hard it is to make games. They're so hard to make. And the designers are like these really amazing.
I can attest to that. It's really
amazing
hard.
People. Yeah. They're just amazing people who do amazing things to make these games happen. And it's really kind of fun for me to get to know them and what they're thinking. So once I know that, and then I can start sketching out themes. And
yeah,
usually it goes pretty smoothly. Usually.
Well, touching on that, then my next question was going to be about the challenges of this particular installment. And did you intentionally make any challenges for yourself as well to push your creativity in the score?
It's a good question. I typically do that. I try to do something I haven't done before.
Or was COVID a challenge enough, you know?
Yeah, there is that. Yeah. I mean, you know, The challenge for me with this one was to make it sound like I felt like it should sound. I don't think I went beyond my ability as a composer on this score as much as I have on others.
Yeah.
This one came pretty naturally, and it was just like the pace of writing was perfect. We started in February, finished in September. It was just like every day was, hey, what am I doing today? And I'm gonna write this theme today. And
Yeah.
so I took that as just a nice distraction from kind of the mental illness that surrounds COVID that we all are sort of grappling with.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be too dramatic, but you know, a lot of people are suffering right now and
I
through
think it's
this
fair
thing.
to
It
be
was,
dramatic in this case. You know, it's I think if it calls for it any time, now is definitely the time.
I think we have to acknowledge that everyone's going through everything right now. So, but it was nice to have the distraction,
Oh,
frankly,
yeah.
and I was grateful for it. And it was kind of a crazy time just in the beginning because, you know, we started in February and everything was sort of blowing up over the following weeks. And I remember the week that, you know, Brian was saying, yeah, they're getting ready to move us all home. And I think in like 3 days, everyone was set up at home.
Oh, wow.
And that's like 300 people that work
Yeah,
at
that's
Treyarch.
fast.
Yeah. So it was, and they all had VPNs and high security and, you know, all this kind of stuff that they have to have because they're making one of the world's most popular games and people are always trying to hack into them and stuff like that. So, it was kind of a minor miracle that they were able to do that. And for me, obviously, there's no difference because I was always at home anyway, with my studio and my garage, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was just amazing to see how they did that so quickly.
Yeah, it's incredible how everyone had to adapt and very fast as well. Now, this might be like comparing apples and bananas or something, but what would you say is the biggest difference between writing for Call of Duty and, say, writing for something like Mass Effect? And what are the similarities, if there are some as well?
Well, you know, it's hard to make that comparison only because, like, I guess it's not completely hard, but you know, the last Mass Effect I worked on was released in 2010,
Yeah.
and then the next, the first Call of Duty was 2012, and Mass Effect was interesting because I didn't get a lot of support in terms of recording. You know, we didn't record any orchestra. I would just record, you know, musicians, sort of on my own, you know, just soloists and things like that, just because I wanted to have some of that in the score. But like, you know, you get into Call of Duties, it's like suddenly you have this huge budget and, you know, orchestra, and there's, you know, it's really, you can have anything you want, really. And, so there's just a more creative constraint on the Mass Effect stuff. And it was mostly, I mean, the reason we didn't have a budget had mostly to do with the fact that I was doing electronic score,
Yeah,
right?
of
So,
course. Yeah.
but when we got to Mass Effect 2, it was sort of, can you mix real orchestra in with, you know, the samples, in with the electronics? And it was like, sure, I can. Can we get a budget? And there was really no movement on that for whatever budgetary reason there couldn't be, and which happens, and you know, but we just sort of plowed along. You know, they're based in Edmonton, I was based in LA, Treyarch is based in LA, I'm based in LA, so it was always easier for me to go and, you know, have FaceTime with people at
Yeah.
the Call of Duty thing, so there's more of a connection there. Whereas the Mass Effect group was, I considered all of them friends, are such nice people, and it was all great, but I only got to see them maybe at the beginning of the project, and that's it, you know.
Yeah. And then
May,
you just
maybe,
disappeared to your
maybe at
cave.
an awards show somewhere in Vegas or something. But yeah, I mean, you know, it was cool. It was a both great experiences, very different companies, and experiences that way. But that's true for almost any game. Like, that it just depends who I'm working with, you know.
Yeah, sure. Must be exciting as well that the vinyl collection is coming out this year ahead of the trilogy remaster.
Yeah, they did a vinyl several years ago,
Yeah.
and now they're doing it again. I'm not really sure what's going on with that. I just heard about it, so.
Yeah, I guess it's like a complete collection.
Yeah, well, it's still four albums. The other one was four albums too. I'm not really sure. It's just, it was a limited run a few years ago. So I guess they're doing it again to be commensurate with the launch of the Legendary Edition. So,
yeah, sure.
Which is just such a cool thing. I mean, you know, God, how many times you get to work in a game that just has another life and another, for another whole generation of players are going to get to play these games, you know,
and yeah,
new systems. And
well, it left such a mark on so many people. That must have felt amazing as well to see so much love for it still.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great series. It's one of my favorite game series for sure.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
The story and the vibe and the atmosphere. It's great. It's just great. Very few games sort of lock that in as well as they have done it. I mean, I like a lot of different games that are story based, but this one, like, it's rare to have a sci-fi game feel so real and personal.
I think the word personal nails it on the head about why it resonated with so many people.
Yeah.
You know, you experienced Mass Effect. You didn't play it. You didn't watch it. You experienced Mass Effect.
Yeah. And the replayability was just all over the map. I mean, you just could have a completely different experience depending on if you're playing Renegade, Paragon, you know, Fem Shep, Male Shep, what, it doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah.
It's like there's so many different ways to play the game.
And you know that it's your experience because of that.
Yeah.
Like, not many people, if any, will have the exact same experience you did.
That's right. And you can also decide, like, I think on this playthrough, I'll try to have a romantic relationship with this person, you know?
Yeah.
With this character. It's just crazy.
Now, my next question can sometimes be extremely short due to the nature of the industry. But what else can you tell us that you're working on at the moment?
I can't say anything.
Yeah.
Everything's NDA'd and I'm not at liberty to say.
Classic, yeah.
It's just is what it is. It's,
yeah,
everybody's secretive. And
of course.
And that's cool, but yeah, I can't really say my very, very short answer.
Yes, well, we're always used to that one. Like, can you tell us what you're working on next? No. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, see you in a year.
Yeah, see you next year. Now, my final question can be a bit of a doozy as well, but I always like to ask my guests, if you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be? And don't say invest in Bitcoin.
Hey, I did.
There you go. You don't need to.
I'm good. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, are you talking about me specifically?
Or yeah, what, if you could give yourself piece of advice for the future.
Myself. Okay. I would say that it's a really tough question because everything so much depends on other people and how things go. But I would say for me, giving my younger self advice is always just, you know, don't forget that you're working for other people who are paying you to do a job and solve a problem, right? Like, don't think that you have all the answers and make sure that, and I'm pretty good at this now, and I've always been pretty good at this, but earlier in my career, I wasn't as good at it. And that is to just, take care of your client as much as you can. Just make sure that they're taken care of. Like, they don't feel like you have another girlfriend or, you know, if you're working on multiple titles, everybody's your most important title, that kind of
yeah.
thing. You know, that's sometimes tough to do, but you got to do it.
So I think we can all relate to that, especially early in our careers when we're still finding our feet. And it's just something that comes with experience as well as just doing it for a while, I think.
Agreed. Yeah.
Which I think is just another way of saying experience. I think I just did there. So. Well, Jack, sadly, our time has come, but it has been an absolute blast having you on the show. And I hope we can see you again in the future.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, this is Sam. Thanks very much for listening to the Sound Architect podcast today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, there are many ways you can support the show, which is incredibly appreciated. Obviously, there's the financial way where you can support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/sounddesignuk. However, there are many other ways which also help, such as liking, subscribing, reviewing, commenting, and sharing via whatever channel you listen on. Thanks so much for your support already. It really is a work of passion for me, and I'd love to keep sharing the knowledge from all these talented and wonderful people. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Tim from Tonebender's Sound Design Podcast. We've been on an awesome run of interviewing and talking to the people behind the best-sounding movies of the last year. Films like Jesus and the Black Messiah, The Trial of the Chicago 7, Wonder Woman 1984, Nomadland, The Sound of Metal, Mank, The Dissident, and even Tenet. If you want to hear these stories and more, check them all out wherever you find your podcasts or at ToneBendersPodcast.com.
Hi, this is Michael Helms, host of the Location Sound Podcast. My recent guest is production sound mixer Byron Mayer, based out of Copenhagen, Denmark. We talk about recording sound on the feature film Torbos, the official Oscar entry for South Africa. Check out the latest episode.
Hi, this is Christian from the Sound Effect Podcast. In our latest episode, you'll hear field recordist adventurer George Vlad from Mindful Audio talk about his travels and work, including his latest library, African Desert, all at soundeffect.com/podcast.